everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to the inaugural episode of Author to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about everything from characters to craft to karma. Everything will be on the table because everything has to be on the table when you are writing. Your only limit can be your own curiosity. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring book reviews, articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and Author is funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. You can learn more about the PNWA and their yearly writers conference at pnwa.org. Well, so here we are, the first episode of Author to Author, and here's how it works. It's very simple. I invite one of the many authors I've had a chance to sit down and talk with onto the show, and I ask the writer three questions, and they ask me three questions, and then we just see where it goes. Now, when I first thought of this format, I thought, I like it. And then I thought, who shall my first guest be? And I didn't have to think long before I came up with the man who has himself interviewed over 3,000 authors before he himself became a best-selling author. And I am talking, of course, about the one and only Frank Delaney. Frank, welcome to Author to Author.
Bill, I'm honored. I'm the first guest. Wow. How good of you to choose me. This is fun.
I just had to. And by the way, happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you so much.
This is the day. Now, Valentine's Day is St. Valentine's, who's Irish, is he not?
His body is preserved, it is said, under the altar in a church, the Carmelite Church, in Clarendon Street in Dublin.
Well, that sounds pretty Irish to me. So do people in Ireland celebrate Valentine's Day? Or is that a purely 100%?
No, it's celebrated in Western Europe quite a lot, actually. And people in Ireland do venerate it. But it's not here it's a much bigger deal, because here it's all kinds of things. For example, I can tell you tonight that in most parts of the UK, the southern UK, you will not be able to get a table for dinner in a restaurant.
Oh, is that right?
Oh yeah, it's a big deal. Where it's celebrated big, pretty well always.
Are you going to do anything with your significant other?
I have already done the flowers thing. I've been very careful. I've been very good, very well behaved, and I'm going to surprise her later. She doesn't know yet.
Oh, good. All right. Well, that'll be our little secret.
Wonderful.
All right. Well, so Frank.
Yes.
You know the format, and
I do. And I love it. Actually, I love it.
Oh, I'm glad.
Because actually, here's an interesting thing, Bill. One of the things I used to notice over the years was if I introduced writers to writers, they rarely talked about writing. They usually talked about agents or money or publishers.
Yes, yes.
Or whatever. But if you got them talking about writing, it very often became magical. It very often became extraordinarily entertaining and educational. That was what I loved about it.
In fact, I was just thinking of this. I was watching a show. I was watching it on Netflix, and it's called Spectacle. And it's Elvis Costello.
Oh, I love it.
Have you seen it?
Yes, I love it.
Isn't that an excellent show?
Did you see the one where Elton John and Diana Krall talked to each other about playing the piano?
I saw the very first episode where he interviewed Elton John, and I thought it was one of the best interviews I've ever seen.
Well, the follow-on to that is Elvis Costello, who hosts Spectacle, is married to Diana Krall, the Canadian piano player and singer and songwriter, and she is immensely talented. And he said on the show that he didn't feel that he could interview his own wife, although I'd have been perfectly happy to see him do it, and he got Elton John to do it. So what you got, of course, was you got two experts talking to each other about playing the piano, and it was completely and utterly riveting. So if you can find it anywhere, it's really well worth seeing.
Yes, it is. And so here we are, a couple of writers, and so you know the format. You are the guest, so you get to either ask or be asked. Which do you choose?
First, you mean?
Yes.
Okay, I choose to ask first.
Oh, all right. I'm ready.
And here's what I have. Here's my question to you.
Okay.
And I've chosen this question because I think a lot of writers will identify with it.
Okay.
When you sit down to write, when you break open a new project, so to speak,
okay.
When the doodling is over, and when you're ready to start assembling the project,
okay,
a book or a short story or whatever, a novel or a short story, whatever, nonfiction, what do you find the most daunting?
The most daunting, when I sit down to start a new project, if it is a longer project, like a book-length project,
yeah,
it is the most daunting when I start a book-length project. I would say it is controlling my enthusiasm.
Huh.
You know, I think back to the book The Horse's Mouth by Joyce Carey.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever read Joyce Carey's
Love
Horse's
it.
Mouth?
Love it. I haven't read it for years. I must reread it now.
Oh, it's excellent. So, of course, she talks to you. It's about a painter and pulled from this painter, Gully Gibson, I think is his name. And he talks about the process all the time. And he's having a hell of a time with this one painting. He can't get it right. And so finally he has the brainstorm, I'll start a new one. And he waxes poetic about the blank canvas, about how pristine and how anything's possible. There's nothing wrong with it. And all the potential is there. And as I read that passage, this was years ago, I thought, oh, that's just the trap. I mean, it's the trap in The Invitation, which is, yes, nothing is wrong with this yet, and nothing is right with it. It's all potential. And to sort of corral my hyper-enthusiasm for what hasn't been written yet and actually get down to the business of finding what it is I actually want to say. And not getting
so elation
carried away with what
elation at that moment is the enemy.
That's right. It kind of is in a way. You know, when I sit down to a short piece, I write a column every day for author.
Sure.
Since I do it every single day, I trained myself to never try to think about what I was going to write before I wrote.
Right.
And just trust that there was going to be something there. I think that's what used to stand in my way when I was trying to write those, thinking that I had to know. But now I know. Now I know very well that I don't
have to
know.
There's the old Nike slogan, just do it.
Exactly. And you kind of write that way too, don't you? I know you have a kind of a plan, but I know you feel your way through very much.
Well, I'm finding that it's very different. I have a new novel out last week, and I'm finding that when I sit down to do the novel, nothing has changed. The first third, I think pretty well all novelists will tell you this, the first third of the novel is the most difficult. And I can spend twice, three times more on the first third of the novel than I will on the final two-thirds put together.
Because you want to get
that,
in right. Is that it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Assembling it. You're assembling there everything that has to go out and shapes everything that's got to come back after the halfway point. But the first third is where you set up all your characterizations, or most of them anyway, unless you have a villain or somebody remarkable appear later in the book quite deliberately, and I've done that too. But the first third is where the difficult thing. And that's always the part which is almost over-prepared. But in response to your not thinking about what you do, I've recently started putting up a series of short stories on the internet,
mm-hmm.
publishing them on Amazon Kindle, as so many other people are doing. These are about 9,000-10,000 words long.
Right.
And they're short stories told in a very specific way. I'm exploring the transfer to print from the oral tradition. So I'm writing them as though a fireside storyteller in Ireland was telling them.
Right. How do you like it?
I like it very much, but what's really interesting is that they're much, much better if I don't overplan them. Much, much better. If I don't overplan these stories, then they will come out much more spontaneously.
Yes. Yes. Oh, I like it. I should let her know we have a caller online. I'm going to say, caller, don't worry. We're going to try and get to you, but I'm going to ask Frank a question here before we do. So I know you're a great fan of James Joyce,
mm-hmm.
great modernist novelist. And whenever I think of the modernists, I think of two men in particular. I think of Joyce and a poet from St. Louis who ended up in London. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Go on.
Mr. Thomas Stearns Eliot.
I know.
You have something in common with Mr. Eliot, something very specific in common with him. Do you know what that is?
We both worked in banks.
That's correct.
Now, I'll tell you something else we have in common.
What's that?
I lived a few miles from where he's buried.
No kidding.
In East Coker in Somerset.
No kidding.
And I very often went over to the little church to visit his grave. And it is absolutely charming, and the American flag is there, and it's just, the whole thing is just utterly charming, and his spirit is very much in the place. And as you know, he wrote the four quartets in a sense in a search for his ancestors, and because he was writing them, the kind of his spirit has imbued the place, and Eliot's very, very much alive there. And one of the wonderful things to do is to go to East Coker and then read the quartets afterwards, and it changes the experience.
How nice is that?
Yeah, I forgot that he was from St. Louis.
What's that? He started there in St. Louis, did he not?
He did, that's right, that's right.
He was born there, yeah.
He's also one of my favorite poets of all time. And the other thing is, when he wrote The Wasteland, I mean, he was only in his early 20s when he did most of his major work.
Yeah, I know.
The thing that fascinates me is that he found almost everything he did appallingly poor.
He did? I didn't know that.
He had a low opinion of much of what he did. I thought, if Eliot thinks that of his work, what in God's name chance do the rest of us have?
This is the curse of the writer, you know. It really is. They always, because you're always wanting to do more. So I want
That's
you to take yourself back to that time when you were working at the bank. And I know you had calculated it almost down to the day, how long you spent.
Oh, I know it to the minute.
Oh, God. Okay, so...
11 years, 4 days, 9 hours,
artist.
And 31 minutes.
How long again, say?
11 years, 4 days, 9 hours, and 31 minutes.
Right, but who's counting?
Well, you know those cartoons, Bill, that you see of convicts in their cells with a roll?
Oh, yeah, count with marking off.
Yes, that's what it was like.
Oh, that's what it was. All right, so talk about that moment. This is something many an artist goes through. I went through it with restaurant work, where you're moving from what they think of as the day job to your next part of your career, which for you was broadcasting, was it not?
That's right, yeah.
So
I got into broadcasting.
About that shift. Do you remember, can you remember when you knew it was going to happen and what allowed you sort of, maybe just emotionally, to make that leap, to feel you could do it?
I remember two things about it. I remember the constant belief that it would never happen.
Oh, really?
And I remember the disbelief in watching it happening. And in many ways, I never allowed myself, not for years and years and years, to think that I had, in fact, arrived in a place something like where I wanted to be.
Yeah.
I had been in banking. While I was in banking, I got involved in theatricals and amateur theatricals and then in semi-professional theatricals and appeared with some professional acting companies. And people there said to me, your voice is suitable for radio broadcasting. You should try for broadcasting. There was only one station, one network in Ireland. That's all there was, one radio station.
Right.
And I made 29 applications
for
a post of an answer. And I did a number of training courses and finally got accepted as a part-time announcer on a three-month, not even on a three-month contract. It was an ad hoc contract. I was paid the equivalent of about $12 per day that I was on for reading four or five bulletins. But here's the point. I didn't know, really, that this was, in fact, happening to me because I was so anxious to get into this field that I crippled myself with the anxiety of wanting to be there. And then when I did get there, I realized what I was doing, which is I was training myself to be a writer because this is a fantastic training.
Yes.
And I met people who trained me. I met people who taught me. I met people who understood the connection between the written word and the spoken word. And that really is where I did my learning.
Yeah. Yeah. So much of writing, I mean, you can go get an MFA program. That's okay. That's okay. But
sure.
so much of it is done in that way. I mean, it's done at the desk. It's done working in radio. It's done on the street corner. It's done so often away from the classroom, I think.
That's right. And when you're finally finished, it's done in the reading aloud that you simply must do before you hand in your work. Otherwise, it will be full of flaws and faults that you have never seen or identified.
It's hard to hear them.
It's very hard to hear.
You can't replace it.
Bill, there's this bind that you have when your reading is aloud, if you're me, which is, oh, my God, this is awful.
Right.
So you can't continue reading it aloud because you have got to go and fix it each time.
Yeah.
And that's another problem. Why do we do it? I don't know. As Margaret Atwood says, nobody ever asked us to. But we still do.
No, no, they never, ever do.
They never asked us to do it.
All right, we're going to try a little something. I have a caller, and
good.
They've been waiting patiently, and I'm hoping they have a great question to pose to both of us. So let's give this a try and see what they have. Caller, are you there? Hello? Well, the caller, well, I'm sorry, caller, if you don't speak up, I can't answer your question. Well, they're gone. Oh, well. C'est la vie. All right, Frank.
Yes,
what's your next question?
My next question for you is, in your terms, when you are writing something or have written something, when you have it assembled and it is finished and you're submitting it, handing it in, whatever, ready to post it, whatever, what, in your terms, equals achievement?
Achievement.
What's your benchmark?
Yeah.
What makes you say, you know, that's okay?
Yeah. I think it's if I surprise myself. I think
Ooh.
That if I move myself, that sense that, do you know, you must have had this experience, Frank, where you've written something, and the only language, in fact, I saw Lou Reed talking about this on the show on Spectacle, and
mm-hmm.
he talked
he was on
about
a Julie, he was on a Julian Schnabel, wasn't he?
Lou Reed, when he didn't write a novel, he majored in fiction in creative or in English
right.
literature in college,
yeah.
but he never wrote a novel, but he wrote all those great songs with Velvet Underground. And he was talking.
But
about
he was on that
novels.
Night, I think, on that show, he was on with Julian Schnabel.
Yes, he did.
It was fascinating,
wasn't it?
It was wonderful stuff.
Oh, so he was talking about how you have to get out of the way. And I think that's exactly what it is for me when I write. However we define I, has to get out of the way. And when I do, it is not unlike having found something in a bookstore that I love. I mean, I know I wrote it. I put the words down. And I was sitting there sort of choosing the words. But there is such a sense of discovery that it's something that sort of came through me. And I'm as delighted with it almost as if I had found something someone else had written. And if I have that experience, I cannot go wrong. When I have that experience, when I have the same enthusiasm for it that I would for someone else's work, then I feel like I've done what it is I was meant to do. And whatever people say about it, it doesn't matter because I did, I think, the best I could. You know, whether
That's what you can do.
A bog or or if it's a whole book. You know, and
that
it,
is
and
all
it,
you can do is the best that you can
yeah,
do
and
at that moment.
Yeah, and I want to move myself. I want to surprise. I want to take myself someplace that I didn't know. That's part of the reason I don't like to think about the columns before I write them, because I want to discover what it is I'm there to learn that day. You know, that to me is the gift to me. And if I've discovered something, I am sure that the reader will have something. Some reader somewhere hopefully will have something.
I love that.
I think that's what I'm shooting for. I really want to let it through. I let it through. Okay, I'm going to try. My caller seems to be back. I'm going to try them one more time. Okay, Frank?
Yes, sure.
Let's give it a try. And if the poor person can't hear us, let's see. Caller, are you there?
Hello, Bill. I am.
Oh, it's Jeffrey. Pretty Jeffrey. How are you doing?
Caller. I don't know what happened to the first caller, but I just got into the queue. I don't have a question. I have a comment. I'm a first-time caller, long-time admirer of your work. Bill writes wonderful blog posts. If anybody hasn't had a chance to get over Author Magazine and read his daily blogs, they must. Wonderful. He is able to put into 500 words, which at times I have difficulty with 5,000.
Oh, my God.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey. It's excellent of you to say.
Wonderful show. I love the idea of the reverse interview. I also do, as you know, Bill, do my own show, so I'm going to try that. I really like this concept. And Mr. Delaney, it's just an honor to listen to you, sir. It's wonderful. And Bill,
thank you so much.
Look, great job.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey.
Bill is a really good interviewer. That's what I like. You know, we all do a lot of this stuff, and you know, the good ones you can count on the fingers of one hand, or as a friend of mine says, on the fingers of one thumb. You know.
I like that, and I could not agree more. I'm going to go so I can listen to the rest of this fascinating show. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to say hi, Bill.
All right. Thanks, Jeffrey.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
All right. Well, there was Jeffrey Pretty. All right, Frank. Now,
yes.
I've got a question for you. You've kind of begun to answer it, but I want you to think back, because the interviewing I've done, I haven't done 3,000, but the hundreds that I've done have meant a tremendous amount to me. I've been writing all my life, so I knew plenty about the craft of writing, I felt, but I learned so much by talking to the writers. You began interviewing writers sort of before you became a professional writer. Is that correct?
Very much so. And in a sense, I seized the opportunity with both hands. I'd been working in Ireland as a sort of general freelance in broadcasting once I left banking. I'd made some documentaries. I'd done a lot of reporting for various, you know, news feature programs. And then I became a news anchor on radio and television. You did both duties there. There was just, as I say, the one station. And then the BBC recruited me to cover the south of Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, for the BBC in Northern Ireland and for the network. And I did that for several years, and it was bombings and shootings and lootings and kidnappings every day.
Right.
It was all during the Irish Troubles. And then I was in London on a trip to see my bosses in the newsroom there. And it was what I was doing was, in terms of news and what was going on, was quite a big deal, even though I didn't know it at the time. It's only later that it has occurred to me, you know, what exactly I was doing. And so I went to see them. But at lunchtime, I met a producer from the arts arena, so to speak, and they said to me, have you ever thought about working in the arts? And I said, I wouldn't be interested in working in the arts. I said, unless I could bring to the arts the urgency of news and current affairs.
Right.
I said, why do you ask? And they said, well, we're looking to do a book show on radio, a really good, accessible book show. Would you like to make a pilot? So I said, sure. So I went off. That was the end of the conversation. I took the person's name and telephone number. I went off and I made a pilot by myself, a half-hour pilot. And the standard had to be capable of being broadcast. And, of course, I was used to cutting my own tape in those days. I didn't have studios or sound engineers or anything like that backing me up. So I went and made this show with various interviews and readings and everything else at my own expense, did all the cutting and all the mixing and music and everything else, and I submitted it. And they called me and said, we didn't mean you to do this. We meant you to come in and work with one of our producers. But now that you've done it, we've played it, and there were 14 other people competing for it. And some of them were very big names indeed.
Right.
But now that you've done it, we would like to submit it to our controller, our channel editor. And I said, sure. And this is a network. This is the Speech and Politics Network.
Yeah.
Radio 4. And back came the word, this is the person who has a passion for books, which was always true.
Yeah.
And that's how it started. And I made the transfer from news and current affairs into arts broadcasting by behaving as though books were a newsy part of our everyday life, which, of course, they are.
Yes.
And it was great, and it was fantastic fun, and that's where it began.
So what did you learn then in those 3,000 interviews? I mean, you probably learned a ton, but when you think back on that, what did you take away that you carried with you into your fiction writing?
You know, it's a great question, and I haven't been asked it in that form before, and there's a fantastic answer to it.
Yeah.
The answer is not mine. It's just the answer is born of experience, and here's the answer. I learned that the best of them, the best of the writers that I met, are also pretty wonderful people.
Yeah, well, that's true.
I learned that the greater the writer, the greater the human being.
Yeah.
I learned that writers, true literary creative artists, have whatever clothing they wear, they have a magnificent generosity to them that is startling, and it is that generosity that enables them to do what they do so beautifully.
I agree, Frank. Generosity is, I think, that art at its best is so generous.
Absolutely.
It has to be so generous to the audience.
Absolutely.
It is, because in fact, you write the book, Frank, but you can't finish it, can you?
That's right. That's only 50% of the job.
The reader finishes it, right?
Yeah, it's only 50% of the job, Bill.
That's right.
You write the book. I have a little, at every book I write, every novel I write, there's a little author's note at the beginning, which sets out, in a sense, it's like a preacher with a text for a sermon. It sets out what the book is about. But in actual fact, it's my valediction. It's my saying to them, okay, listen, I've done my job. Now, here's your 50%. You do the rest. And it is amazing. And they do it.
Yeah.
And that's the wonderful thing.
And you have to let them. You have to. You know the expression. You do tell a story, but you also you share it.
You allow it. Yes,
they're going to know. All the thousands of readers, the tens of thousands of readers you have, none of them have read the same book, right?
That's
because they've all read their own version of it.
And the thing that I noticed was that the same experience in interviewing them all, the thing that I really noticed as well was this, that the really great ones are hugely aware of the reader, an immense consciousness of the reader, and they would always talk. I remember, for example, a very snooty producer booked me to do an interview with Ed McBain at my insistence. The late
right.
Evan Hunter. And this producer was Oxbridge educated and wasn't as democratic about writing and literature as I am, didn't have any popular range in their reading. It was entirely literary classics and so on and so forth, and a lot of avant-garde reading as well. And I said, no, he'll be wonderful. So he came in, we booked him for a quarter of an hour. He stayed for 2 hours, and he gave us a masterclass in storytelling and a masterclass in reaching the reader.
Wow.
He was absolutely wonderful. But his entire emphasis, and this was held in common with most of the other writers, if not all that I've interviewed, his entire emphasis was on the reader.
Interesting.
He wasn't interested in his own ego in that sense. He was interested in how he was going to read and entertain the reader and hold their attention.
Yeah. Well, you have to, because what are you doing otherwise?
What else have you got?
You do want to amuse yourself, it's true, but there's a sense of that other. You can't get away from it.
Else have you got? If you're not looking after your reader, you're not doing your job.
I agree.
And that's
I agree.
One of the major
okay. Oh, I like that answer. All right. So, if you got a third question, Frank?
I have a third question. Name one all-time ever, and possibly the only one, if you can do it, favorite literary character. Is it
literary
Ahab?
Character.
Is it Ahab? Is it Bloom? Is it Gatsby? Is it Becky Sharp in Vanity Fair? Who is it?
Oh God! All right. This is a total cliche, but I don't care. And that is Holden Caulfield. I love the guy. I love him. I never read him until I was 40. I didn't read the book. I refused to read him when I was young because I was told I was supposed to. I was supposed to read Catcher in the Rye. I said, I'll be goddamned if I'm going to read what I'm supposed to read. So I didn't. And I looked up. I was 40. I was like, why haven't I read this dumb book? And I loved it. And
there's a wonderful English professor of literature called Christopher Ricks teaching in Boston. And he has a phrase which says, a cliche is a phrase worn smooth by rubbing. In other words, it got to be a cliche because it is universally accurate. It's universally accurate. So, therefore, a cliche is a good thing.
Yeah. I don't care. I love that book, and I love that character. I mean, yeah, he's young, but I will never tire of a character asking what it's all about. That is my question. That's the one I'm most interested in.
And he asks what it's all about in such an original way.
He does.
And in a way in which we can identify with. You know,
I mean, there's a lot of great characters. I mean, I love Gatsby and, well, anyway, there's a lot of them. But I have to say, that one pops to mind. I have a special place in my heart for Salinger, I have to say.
Oh, so do I. So do I. There's a story of his called A Perfect Day for Banana Fish.
Yes,
which I go back to again and again, you know, Franny and Zooey, which, of course, escaped the attention it should have had because of Catcher in the Rye. Everybody was wanting him to write the next Catcher in the Rye, and which he didn't want to do, quite rightly. But he's just wonderful. And the other thing about him is, if you look at him, I have an exercise that I do with writers, which is I try to edit them.
Oh,
just to see how good they were. Just to see how good they were. You cannot get a razor blade into Salinger's work.
No,
you know, he's absolutely superb. He's totally spot on.
Unfortunately, on Salinger, I hear the little voice in my ear telling me our time is nearly up.
Oh, Bill.
How fast that went?
Parting is such sweet sorrow.
Frank, it is always a delight to talk to you.
Good luck with the show.
Frank was recently named. Quickly tell us, how were you named the most eloquent man in the world, Frank? You've got about 10 seconds.
It's Scott Simon at NPR, and I'm still trying to devise a method of revenge that satisfies that, because everywhere I go, I'm introduced as that by speakers, and I'm going to pay him back one day.
Well, in my mind, that's it. You're the most eloquent man in the world. You just got to live with it. Frank,
thank you so much, Bill.
It's a delight.
Good luck.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
And thank you for listening, everybody. Please join us next week. Our guest will be Diane Hammond, author of the surprise bestseller Hannah's Dream. This has been Author to Author with Bill Knauer. And you can find more about Author Magazine on authormagazine.org and learn about the Pacific Northwest Writers Association on the PNWA.org. See you later. See you next Tuesday.